The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
I'm joined now in the studio by the EU Commissioner for Democracy, Justice, the Rule of Law and Consumer Protection, Michael McGrath. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Claire.
You're very welcome. You're about a year and a half out of domestic politics now.
Yeah,
so when you see the by-elections happening, Dublin Central, Galway West, does it make you want to roll up your sleeves and get out on the canvas?
I had 25 years in Irish politics at local and national level. I started really young. My first election in my local town council area in Passage West in Cork was at the age of 22. So I really enjoyed it.
You put in your time.
Had fantastic experience. But I'm delighted to be where I am and to have the opportunity to shape and influence policy across 27 countries, including Ireland, and 450 million. It's an extraordinary privilege. Mm-hmm. And a year and a half in, it's been a very steep learning curve. I've thoroughly enjoyed it and got to grips with the mechanics and the workings of the different EU institutions and finding out how to actually influence
and have an impact on policy. We'll talk in detail about your brief, but I'm sure you keep a close eye on the headlines here, and you'll have seen that Bertie Ahern has been in hot water today and yesterday, accused in the Dáil by Paul Murphy of disgusting racism. What's your view on it? Was it that, or was it a canvasser? Particularly, we think of Bertie in this context, telling somebody on the doorstep what they wanted to hear.
Well, I think we all have an obligation to be very careful about what we say in the European Union. I think we can be proud of the fact overall that we do have a Charter of Fundamental Rights that applies to everybody living in the European Union. And one of those fundamental rights is non-discrimination and the importance of upholding the integrity of every human being, the decency and dignity of every human being. And I think it's important that all of us do our best every day to uphold those values, because it's when we start speaking about an entire group of people based on race or colour or ethnicity, it's a very slippery slope. And I think we have to avoid language that is divisive, that can be interpreted a certain way, even if that's not the intention. And I don't believe for a moment that Bertie Ahern is racist. I just don't believe that. I've known him a long time, but he clearly shouldn't have said what he said. Whether he actually believed it, I don't know.
He clarified his comments, but he hasn't apologised. Do you think that he should apologise?
I think it's for him. You know, it's not for me to call on somebody to apologise for what they have said. I think he has responded, but clearly it shouldn't have been said, because it does run contrary to our values. I mean, we should never shy away from having a debate about migration, and that's a debate that's happening throughout the European Union, by the way, and the EU has been responding with new policies, including a migration and asylum pact. And we also recognise that most people coming into Ireland and coming into the EU from outside are here to make a contribution, make an economic contribution, and come through the regulated permit and visa system
There's a way to have a conversation.
A conversation is perfectly legitimate, but what you can't do is speak about an entire group of people based on their race, country of origin, ethnicity, and to speak of them in a disparaging manner. That is a slippery slope and is one that we really shouldn't be going down.
Okay. I'm interested to hear your view as well, and whether you can tell us if there was any disquiet at an EU level with regard to how the Irish government solved the fuel protests issue with a spend of 750 million with a deferral of the carbon tax increase as well. Eyebrows raised or not?
So the European Union has been very supportive of member states in responding to the energy shock and the price increases that households and businesses have been facing. And we have made certain changes to our rule book, including easing state aid requirements, giving more flexibility to member states in relation to taxation decisions under the Energy Tax Directive. What we have said is that we encourage member states to introduce measures in a timely manner, but also in a temporary manner, and where possible in a targeted manner.
Mm-hmm. And issue with the 750 million.
We have been engaging with the Irish government on a bilateral basis, and the government wrote to the European Commission seeking certain permissions and consent to do certain policy decisions, and the EU has been very supportive. We do make that overall point about the need for interventions to be timely, temporary and targeted. it, because it is important that you can find a way out of these measures that can be difficult.
Would
and
you
I know
have
that
done
from
it?
National experience.
Would you have done it?
I think the government had to respond to the price shock. I'm not going to get into the issue of the protests and the manner of them, but the government was considering certain measures, had already introduced certain excise cuts. We did that previously, as you know, a few years back when there was an energy price shock arising from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So I think when people are under pressure, where governments have the resources to help, they should do so. But they do have to be mindful of the overall journey that we're all on within the European Union, which is one towards energy security and energy independence, because this now is twice in 4 years that the people of Europe have suffered the brunt of an energy shock that has been caused by outside forces, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and now the Israel-US war in Iran and the Strait of Hormuz. So have to develop energy security.
But you could argue that deferring the increase in the carbon tax goes against that agenda of becoming less dependent on fuel from outside sources.
Well, the carbon tax in Ireland has been one of the most, I would say, innovative and progressive and pro-environmental measures that has been adopted in the European Union. It has been difficult to do, and it has been developed, as you know, incrementally, and the resources have been used for environmental measures, including retrofitting and supporting farmers on their journey towards decarbonisation as well. And the government has made what is a national decision. The EU does not interfere in that national decision. There are EU rules on taxation, but we have given member states leeway to do what they need to do.
There's
to support households
there.
Because of the exception situation we're in. But we cannot take our eye off the ball overall, which is that we have to prevent this happening on repeat, that every few years there's an energy shock because of our dependence on fossil fuels and our dependence on external sources of energy. So we need to have a mix that is right for each member state, but ultimately that we can stand on our own 2 feet and have homegrown clean sources of energy.
You made the really difficult calls when you were in finance and public expenditure around what to do with taxation. And you look now at, as we come up to the budget in October, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael seem to be at one that there should be tax cuts in Ireland. Do you think it's the right time to do that?
Look, these are very much domestic policy decisions that the government has to make.
But I'm just drawing on your expertise,
And it's always difficult because you have to weigh up competing demands on the taxation side and on the expenditure side. But what I am very proud of is the initiative we brought in to set up the long-term funds, because we do need to, across the European Union, get to a position where we manage the economy and we manage public finance through a long-term prism. And so when I brought forward the idea of setting up the Future Ireland Fund, the Infrastructure Fund, I understand that by the end of this year, of the order of 25 billion will be in those funds.
Now people say there's too much money sitting there while people are really desperate, you know.
But isn't it a good thing that the government has the resources to respond and has been in a position to respond? And when I look across the European Union, without doubt, the scale of the response and the intervention by the Irish government is on the high side, and I think appropriately so, given the very high cost of energy here and the fact that government has had the resources to do so.
Okay,
but that does mean that in times when you can save money and you need to be careful with money and put money away, then you should, so that you have it in times when you really need it. And that's why when I was Minister for Finance, working closely with Pascal Donoghue, we took that view that there was a need for long-term planning to set up a fund. It's not for a rainy day, because if you look at the long-term costs that are coming Ireland's way around demographic costs, pension costs, care costs, they're certain.
It'll be a rainy day. They will for sure come.
And we know from the past that the last thing you should do in a downturn is to cut infrastructure spending. You actually should push against the wind
and increase investment. You're not going to dip your toe in the income tax debate.
No, certainly not. It would be completely inappropriate. It's a matter for the Irish government.
Let's go to your own brief then. And the Irish Times saying this morning that you are, or are you, they ask, the big tech whisperer of the EU. And the point is also made in that article by Jack Power, being seen to be too cozy with big tech can be a political vulnerability. Are you too cozy with them?
Absolutely not. I believe in dialogue, and I meet with businesses across all sectors relevant to my portfolio, but also with wider stakeholders, civil society, the media, human rights organisations, on a constant basis. But I make no apologies for having ongoing dialogue with the tech sector because of my portfolio. So I'm responsible for data protection, so GDPR, international data flows, digital fairness. Later on this year, I'll bring forward a Digital Fairness Act, and the tech sector are an important stakeholder they should be engaged with and listened to. But I listen to a wide array of voices on a constant basis.
When Meta say that you're the only person that they can get traction with in the EU, it makes people wonder whose side you're on.
I'm on the side of the European people, and I take an oath as an EU commissioner to act in the interests of the European Union and the European citizens. And bear in mind, when we as EU commissioners hold meetings, everything is done in a transparent way. Every meeting is logged. Notes are kept of meetings. I meet with a wide array of stakeholders, and the job is very transparent in that way, as it should be, because of the impact of the decisions that we make. But I make no apologies for engaging with the tech sector. I do so regularly, as I do with other sectors, because of the nature of my brief, which is very much about data. It's about consumer protection. If you think about how more and more of us are doing our shopping online, and that raises consumer protection issues. You think about the role of technology when it comes to protecting the integrity of democracy and elections, the spread of disinformation. So this contact and engagement is actually crucial, so that they understand EU policy, that I can explain EU policy, what it means and what it doesn't mean, but also that they have an opportunity to set out their point of view.
The consensus, I think, for most people is that the tech companies have way too much power over us. Like, they're capturing our children before they leave primary school, and any attempts to regulate them seem to fall at the first hurdle. Can you commit that that is going to change? Because this week we see them over in China with Donald Trump. So it looks as though it's China, America and big tech, and the EU standing on the sideline looking on.
Well, I think it's important to emphasise that the EU is a world leader in digital regulation. And when I travel around the world as an EU commissioner, there is a huge amount of interest in the EU's approach to digital regulation, because the rest of the world is waking up to these very issues that the EU has been focused
on
for a number of years.
They're telling us to lay off.
Well, actually, if you look across the United States at a state level, you have many initiatives that are focused on child protection online in particular. You have state-led initiatives to regulate big tech. So we need to get the balance right. Within the EU, as you know, President von der Leyen has set up an expert panel to examine the issue of child safety online. We expect that they will report back in July, and we will come to a prompt decision then about whether to propose an EU-wide legislation in the area of social media and age restrictions.
But very early on in this administration, JD Vance came and outlined their position on the regulation of big tech. And you'll remember that he said, you know, this is about free speech. You need to back off here. Has that position changed, do you sense?
Look, the United States administration is entitled to their view, but they too are grappling with the same issues that we are when it comes to the impact of technology. And technology is transformative, brings huge benefits, but you need to have guardrails. The same is true, for example, when it comes to AI.
They're so cozy with them, though, aren't they? Bringing 27 of them off to meet the Chinese this week.
That's their own business. That's the way they conduct policy making, and they travel together. That's the way they do it. But from the EU's point of view, we have our own approach. We have a robust system of regulation, because you do need to have safeguards in place, in particular to protect children online. So later on this year, when I bring forward the Digital Fairness Act, it will address issues like addictive design. It will address some of the unfair personalization we see, where children are being targeted with advertisements based on their profile, for example. So we're seeking to address the potential harms that are being caused to children in the online environment.
And on that,
it's so important that we do talk to everybody. And as you say, you know, many parts of the big tech sector are none too pleased with the EU. So that's, I think, significant in the context of your earlier questions.
What about influencer content? Do you think more needs to be done there so we're clear what is paid for and what is genuine opinion?
For sure. And while there is regulation in Ireland, that's not the case throughout the European Union. I think what is important is that the ordinary person, the consumer, knows if there is a commercial element to this post, if it is essentially a paid for transaction. Mm-hmm. Other issues that I will be looking at include, you know, online subscription traps. We all sign up to free trial periods for different services.
You can't get out of them.
They roll on automatically into a permanent commitment. There's no obvious way of getting out of it. And sometimes you can spend a lot of time trying to navigate an exit. So making things like that much clearer, much simpler. I'm looking at issues around dynamic pricing. So in the event ticket sector, for example, we all know the high profile cases where people are queuing for hours. The ticket they thought was going to be €70 is now €400. At a minimum, I believe there should be more information and transparency to the consumer that the ticket, you know, is ranging from €70 to €400. And if you're 2 hours into a queue, I think you should know that the ticket you're queuing for is now charging, selling at €300, for example.
Before you get to the checkout.
Basic pro-consumer measures that I think we should be implementing and which fall under my responsibility as consumer protection.
Mr. Patrick O'Donovan has said this week that he is prepared to go it alone on the ban or restrictions on social media for under 16s. Can we do that as a member state?
A number of member states are already doing that and have introduced or announced legislation. I do think it's better that we have an EU-wide approach to this issue. And that's why, as I've said, come the summer, midsummer, there will be a decision by the European Commission on this issue.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a view on it?
I will await the final report from the expert panel because they will make recommendations to us. I'm not convinced how effective or how implementable a hard ban will be. Mm-hmm. We are trying to develop the toolbox.
Well, the Australian experience is that they just get, you know, under 16s just get past it.
Yeah, let's wait and see. And we are examining that model, and we have brought forward an EU age verification app that's now ready and complete. So one part of the question is, what is it that you want to do? And then the second part is, well, are you able to do it and how can you do it? So we have to make sure that we can answer the second part as well. But it could well be that the answer is in the area of more parental control, turning off certain settings by default, dealing with issues like infinite scrolling and so on. So we're looking at all of that. But one option is an actual age restriction. But we need to be sure that we can implement it, that it will actually work in practice.
Now, this democracy shield approach that you've launched to tackle disinformation and election interference, just for people listening, for all of us, does that mean a faster response to deep fakes, to last minute election lies, essentially?
So we have extensive legislation in place in the EU already to deal with these issues, and we are trying to fine-tune and hone that legislation. So we have the DSA, that's the Digital Services Act. We have the AI Act that will later on this year impose an obligation, again, that if there is AI-generated content like deepfakes, that it's labelled, because it's becoming increasingly difficult for all of us to tell the difference between what's real and what's not real. So that will come into force later on this year as well. We have the GDPR. Then we're looking to strengthen the role of media. We have a European Media Freedom Act. We have an anti-slaps directive, which is about making sure that strategic lawsuits designed to silence the media are not entertained, are not countenanced. But the Democracy Shield is taking, you know, quite a wide lens to all of this. It's about making sure fundamentally that we have free and fair elections in the European Union. And later on this morning, I'll meet with the Electoral Commission, Commissioner Tauchon here in Dublin to discuss their work. The holding of elections is a national matter. It's a national competence, but we do bring the electoral authorities together to help them. We are going to produce guidance on AI in elections and also bring forward a recommendation on safety in politics, as well as investing in digital literacy.
Okay.
And we have a new EU centre now, which I have set up, which is about coordinating the good work that has been done around the EU to detect where there are orchestrated and coordinated campaigns of misinformation and disinformation, because we do see increasingly the use of hybrid attacks on the European Union.
There's that at the extreme end, but people do get concerned about overreach when they hear this, you know, and whether we're veering into policing opinions. So how do you safeguard
against that? Absolutely not. In fact, freedom of expression is a fundamental right of every person in the European Union, and it must be protected. And of course, there are safeguards. You can't encroach into the area of hate speech or, you know, discriminating against people based on their profile and background and so on. But the right to express a strong opinion is absolutely sacrosanct and will be fully protected. So I will be ensuring that in no way does this effort encroach on that right or approach anything that looks like censorship.
Just before we finish, the EU presidency is coming to Ireland, of course, in July for 6 months. The commissioner says that we are ready from a security point of view. Are you satisfied with that, that Ireland is ready, that its security here will be proportionate and can deal with what's coming? Because we clearly are, and it's accepted, we will be a target once this presidency arrives here.
Undoubtedly, it will put the focus on Ireland holding the presidency of the Council of the European Union. I do have faith in the national authorities. Bear in mind that they are working very closely with the European Union, and there is extensive coordination in the preparations and the approach for the EU presidency. I would say overall, it's a fantastic opportunity for Ireland to showcase all that is good about the country. Ireland, without question, is an example of a country that has made, you know, great gains on the back of EU membership, and many other countries look to Ireland, and I've picked that up many times over the last year and a half. Ireland is seen as an exemplar, so it's a great opportunity for Ireland to put its best foot forward and to provide leadership for the European Union at a time when competitiveness, security and defence, our values such as democracy and other issues are to the fore.
All right, well, Commissioner McGrath, thank you very much for coming in. That's Michael McGrath.
The Clare Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.